Welcome to Poetry and Conversation at the Centre for Stories. I'm Amy Lynn, and tonight I'll be in conversation with Sarah Rice, award-winning Australian poet. We chat about the power of language, debunk the myth of the jack-of-all-trades, and discuss how family, philosophy, and art have influenced Sarah's craft. This recording starts midway through one of Sarah's poems.
Of a morning. Despite the fact that in a few hours all will be done again in reverse. All will be undone. And there will be no one to see. No one will know the bed corners were tucked into triangles. No one will see the sleeves cross empty, arms against flattened chests and wait quietly. No one will know if the spoon was licked before it re-entered the jam jar. And no one will call you to bed and to the relief of sleep. That midnight hour must be crossed alone. The curtains drawn and redrawn, drawn and erased. Be wary of sitting too long in a warm place, of holding cups of tea for too long, or lying in bed thinking in the morning. Be up and at 'em, up and doing. Be the bird that gets the worm before it eats the apple. Try to resist writing poetry. So it's a nice little poem, really, about those things that you have to do to keep yourself going, you know, just the regularity of all of those little things that we do and how strange that can be. Often we'd say when you're living on your own and you think, oh, I just got up and made the bed and now I'm getting into the bed and now I'm remaking the bed and now the curtains open and they're sharpening. And that strange sense, but in some ways that those regular things we do, those ritualistic things we do, are in a way what also keeps us balanced and keeps us going and those sorts of things as well. And maybe one last thing, and I know I'll stop talking because it's meant to be an in-conversation, not just me monologuing, is something like this I like trying to represent, where you've got this idea of the midnight hour being crossed alone. So we've got this sense of crossing of the midnight hour. So I like the fact some of these ones are quite representational, the cups of tea, for instance, but they don't have to be. They can be quite abstract concepts in there, in that idea. And as you see, they weren't, each picture wasn't a direct link to it, a line in the poem, say. It was just the whole series was meant to reflect the themes of the poem. So I thought I'd just start with that.
Yeah, great. I'll come back to ekphrasis and reverse ekphrasis a little bit later.
Great.
But I'm interested in how diverse your interests are. You've got the PhD in philosophy and a graduate diploma in visual art. You're interested in music. You're in a choir. Can you tell us about where poetry sits in your life in relation to all of these other interests and how you came to poetry and what it means to you?
Oh, wow, that's a sort of multi-barreled question. Mm-hmm. I would say maybe the best... I would love to answer that by saying poetry is smack bang in the middle and it's sort of the hub. But the trick to that is that had you said, where does music stand? I'd probably say smack bang in the middle. Yeah. Where does visual arts stand? Where does philosophy smack bang in the middle? And I suppose I do in fact see it like a moving series of hubs, where at a certain point one thing is grounding all of those other ones and they can sort of take turns.
Yeah.
And I think that's, for me, how they all group together.
Yeah.
I used to have a little bit of that fear, I don't know if anyone else is like this, where if you do a number of things, particularly, say, within the arts, you can almost hear your mind saying, jack of all trades, master of none. You think, oh, no, have I taken on too many things? How can I possibly, succeed in all of them? Yeah. Is that just being crazy? I've now completely... abandoned that as a thought. I've managed to turn it off. I recommend everyone else to do the same because actually they all contribute to each other.
Yeah.
And the older I've got and the more I've done it, the more I've realised absolutely does my poetry inform my creative practice, my visual practice. Absolutely does philosophy inform my poetry.
Yeah.
Absolutely does music come through the way in which I write poetry. And they're all actually helping each other one.
Yeah.
So it's not that they pull you apart. It's not that they take your focus away. They actually gather it together. It's an enfolding. It's as I say, it's sort of a hub, and each one can work as a magnet or a vortex, as you can see. I'm overly too many metaphors, drawing all of the other ones in together. And it doesn't matter which one's in that central part at the time.
Yeah.
So I'll have different times where one will be more primary than others.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I was thinking about that phrase because I read your Axon interview and where you had said that fear of being a jack of all trades, but I just think that really having many interests can only enhance each other. They can only add to and contribute to, like you say, each other, rather than meaning that you would be less competent at the other.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah. You've said you've never knew a time when you weren't surrounded by poetry and that your parents quoted it at the table. Can you talk a little bit about some of your poetry influences?
Oh, yeah. I am one of those incredibly lucky people, which I now realise also, as you get older, you realise how lucky you are, that I was brought up with poetry. Both my parents loved poetry. My mum, these are sort of plugs for my parents, my mum was the first woman to win the prize for poetry reading, big, you know, prize for poetry reading at Leicester University in England. First woman. I think that's great. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping to follow in her footsteps. So this is something she loved doing. I mean, she was an actress. She was a trained actress and literature teacher. Looking at our lovely literature teacher in the audience. Something that she loved and really passed that on to us. And obviously then the presentation of poetry became really important too. It's not just writing. It's also how to really get it across, how to read it well, how to perform it. How to act it. And I suppose with her theatre background, that really helped. And my father, who's Western Australian, hence why we're partly over here, he was born in Western Australia and went to University of Western Australia. So I think he'd be very pleased that my book was published by University of Western Australia Press. That's very exciting. And he studied poetry and philosophy at that time. And we'd play all sorts of games at the table, poetry quoting games, which I thought was normal. It was only when I went at some point to primary school, I think about year five, year six, and people saying, what game will we play? And I said, let's play homonyms and homophones. And they just looked at me and I'm like, did you play homonyms and homophones? Apparently not everyone does play that. But, yeah, so we were really lucky. We'd play these quoting games where someone gives a quote and the next person has to find one word in that quote to quote from, and you do this sort of thing around the time. I mean, my parents could just quote endlessly to you. So I think in that way I was really lucky. Yeah, and as I say, in that way I've never been without poetry. It's always been surrounded. And, you know, in those times, like in primary school where you're asked by your creative writing teacher, you know, in kindy or something, to write a little book of a little short story or something, I was doing poems, so my mum kept them, and I've got my first little book is a book of poems about swans. I think it was about grade one. So I love poetry from swans. It's a whole little collection of poetry about swans. Yeah. So I've always loved it.
And who were you reading growing up?
Oh yeah, that's also good question. One of my thinking, and I think this is important to honour teachers as well, I'm stressing quite a lot about school and projects. So I remember really clearly a project probably about year eight where we had to make an anthology of poetry. Oh. And I loved it. I dedicated myself to that project in a way I've probably never done before or since, and collected all the poems that I loved, and they were a mix, Robert Graves, Dylan Thomas. I mean, interesting, I came to all these poems that I loved, and you'd stick them in your little book and I'd write on the other side what I loved about them, and I made this huge anthology. So I think a lot of the greats. T.S. Eliot still is one of my big favourites, so my aim is to memorise the whole of the Four Quartets off by heart, of which I've got all of Burnt Norton and most of Little Ginning and large amounts of the in-between, so I do love those. I love Dylan Thomas for his wordplay, and that's probably closest to my style, I suppose, of that love of the lyrical word tumbling over each other, effervescent, rollicking sound wave, riding the sound wave of what I love. So probably those ones.
Great. This collection is your first full-length collection and it's called Fingertip of the Tongue. And I think the title really, it really foregrounds the themes of materiality and texture, particularly of language, and especially that image of tactility sitting alongside speech or language. So in the opening poem you say, words put their hands on us and press. So I was just wondering if you could comment on this idea that words and language are tangible and tactile.
Ah, yes. Well, it is something that I really believe. And really interested in. And that poem is one of those, I think every poet's got a sort of perennial poem, or the poem they are trying to give birth to for many, many years. That poem took a long time. It's one of the few poems that I really, you know, kept reworking, kept changing. You can see manifestations of it, you know, stretching back in different forms. Mm-hmm. There are many other poems in that book that were earlier attempts to try and capture it, one called The Saying and the Said, drawing a lot on philosophy about this different idea of the saying, the actual process of saying versus the said, what's written in a way.
Yeah.
There's another one called Finding the Words, which is also a lot about the tactility of words. There's one called Fishing Tackle, which is saying words are hooks for fishing with, and talks about meaning being like fish that you're trying to gather, and whether you bribe them or hook them and catch them. And so this attempt to try and nail down what is it about the tactility, how do we grasp words? And I think the other thing that led me to that as a concept is is language itself, the fact that we do say we're speaking bluntly or speaking harshly or sharply, or gee, those words were very bitter, or those were, you know, so we use these words to describe words that are actually much more about material touch or taste. And that really interested me, and it did get me thinking, how would we treat words if we thought of them as material objects? And I think in parentheses, you have to remember also, I've spent many years teaching at an art school, particularly teaching craft and design students. These are the furniture makers, glass blowers, gold and silversmith makers, woodwork, chair, furniture people, you know, object makers. They're out there sanding, and so things like the different grade of sandpaper, the different texture of something, seeing the glasses polishing and polishing till something's smooth. It made me think, what if the words we pass to another were not spoken, but were objects? And that you could say to someone, oh, you know, here's a word for you, here's my speech to you, and you say, ooh, little bit, you know, blunt, a little bit rough, a bit rough-edged, that. Wow, could you send that back a bit more? The same way that I would say, or someone else would say to the glass student, they'd come up and feel their object. Oh, think you need another grade of sandpaper. And, you know, sandpapers come in grades. Oh, you don't need an 8. Oh, you need a 15. And imagine if we could do that in our speech. Say, oh, take that back and give it to me. Say that to me again with a 15 sandpaper, please. And now might be a good time just to do one of the... I've only got three, so I won't bore everyone with the images. But just because it happens to relate, that poem, Speaking Bluntly... we'll come back to... That's the third one. It's easiest to go forward through these. Into your poetics. Okay, so this is another of the ones where I'd written that poem, which in a way had come about because of teaching art and the materiality of objects. I then wrote that poem and finally felt like I think I finally said what I was trying to say in that poem, which is nice. It's the one that won the Run Pretty. Yeah. So that was not... I'm not saying that to blow the wind up my bum, so much as to say I did finally feel like, oh, I think I've sort of said what I was trying to say. And it's nice then when it feels like that poem lands. And that's also why I chose to start the book with that poem, because you think, I think I've managed to capture what it was. So then from there, I did a show called Material Poetics with a few other poets and artists who were interested in exactly your question, the tactility, the materiality of words. There were people like bookmakers in there who talk a lot about the important things we forget, like the feel of a book, the feel of the paper, the type of font, the text, how dark is it? Can you see the words through the page? All those things that we forget, especially now that we're writing on screens and used to reading things on a computer. So we got together an exhibition called a group show called Material Poetics, and I used that poem, Speaking Bluntly, and the other ones that I sort of mentioned to you, Finding the Words, The Saying and the Said, Fishing Tackle, a few of these other ones, to do a show. So here's an example of what I was saying about, like, speaking softly, speaking bluntly, speaking sharply. And I'd use a mixture of things like hooks. I'd make these funny little flies up of half earrings and half feathers and print on sandpaper, to that idea of the sanding, the smoothing, and use different types of printing techniques. And I had an odd, this is just some of my wall, I had an odd mix of things for that show. So some, you can see a palpable paddle there that I had, many framed works, often with things to do with fish, fur, texture, sandpaper, braille, which comes into the poem you'll hear in a second, feathers, all these different different things, steel wool, etc., etc. And some of them also have words in them. This is from one of the other poems. There is perhaps a god in words, hiding not in their text, but their texture, which really sort of sums up the whole idea, hiding not in the sense, but the sensation. And it used things like, this was a huge big belt sander that I'd found from one of the woodworkers, and it was from a different poem that talked about the way butter on hot toast sinks in, the way that words enter us, the way butter on hot toast sinks in. And this looks a bit like toast, but of course it's a huge big sandpaper. Or things like, which also is a line from another of the poems, the words can be scratching like a hair shirt. That I've used the paintbrush. So some found objects, others again going back to the printing, to the cups, which you saw in the other series. These are printed onto sandpaper using a special inkjet printer. Other used sandpaper, fish, again another found object, talking about how do we get the words to happen, you know, with a hook or with a bribe or with a barb. How do we capture people with our words? How do we hook them in? So I found this beautiful old fishing tackle box, and talking about the idea that some words are like the fly, alive, sapphire, faceted, you know, canary on a string, a tiger lily floating, this wonderful, joyous sense that you can get with words as well, and some more different sanders. So then for my Speaking Bluntly poem, which I'll just quickly read to you.
Yeah, please
do. I
think
I actually know this one off by the way anyway. But I'll need to read it to see where I put the pictures. So I just have chosen for you now where I can show some of the images that would go with the poem. So Speaking Bluntly. If words had a weave, we would feel when our lover spoke to us in Hessian, when we needed satin taffeta, and more subtle vocal fibres, the inflection of cashmere over merino or mohair. Or perhaps better, if words spoken could be felt like braille, a sensitive perception of the digits under the fingertips, six dots raised, pinpricks really, but the pattern is all. If the sound of the letter felt inside the cheek could have its sharpness tested by tongue and teeth before the utterance leaked out, before lips parted company, we could test the word for bitterness the way we test a grape, sucking on the sour fruit in the dark fist of the mouth, holding it against the light to examine its translucence. Clarity and obscurity are measurements of density, the length of a word's shadow, its resistance to light, how sure-footed it is in the dark. Sometimes it seems impossible that speech is spoken by the likes of tongue or lips, those bodily, blood-filled servants to flesh and heart, hatred and dreams. If words were guests only in the mouth, surely we would send them forth full and warm, and perhaps they would carry our message with more care. Words stick in our teeth like peppercorns. We are so very aware of the rough edges of the apple core against our mouth's sore corner, of the tough leather bay leaf left in by mistake, or the softness of silken tofu. Our lips know for certain the thick ceramic mug and the thin porcelain rim. We are so good at discerning too stale, too salty, too dry or too hard. If we could ink up our words like a thumbprint, analyse the friction ridges, pick up the underlying interface of the epidermis, the better to transmit signals, the evidence would present not the word itself, but its pressure, and through impression, intention, weight. Words put their hands on us and press. Speech leaves its imprint, a smoky graphite smudge, with its map of thin white lines, where the fine print lies.
Well done. It's like like a kind of synesthesia of language, and I think you really do an amazing job of remembering. It's almost like you've internalized your own words, and that you can memorize them and perform them without looking at the script.
Yeah, I do. I at one stage, I think I knew all of them. I mostly know all of them off by heart. I tend to find that it's a lovely thing to be able to see your audience, to engage with them, to look people in the eye. It's an amazing way of also keeping you embodied, I think, because we can get very just read, and it can become quite easy to almost forget someone's there. And that's when we tend to read too fast. We've all heard poets read too fast, and I talk fast, so I'm sure I would read fast if I read. So it's a way of grounding you.
Mm.
You see the people. It reminds you that you're actually communicating to someone.
Yes.
Reminds you to use your hands the way we would when we talk, and to slow down or to take a breath, or when you can see people thinking. And so I like it as a way of engaging.
Yeah, so we've been talking about the tactility of language, but I wondered if poetry is something different, because I mentioned to you that the poem in verse, which I'll get you to read shortly, suggests that the poem is something other than tactile. I was just wondering if you could read that poem and talk a little bit about the way you see poetry, and if the way you see poetry is different to the way you see language.
Well, that's a really tough question. Do you have the
page? Page 29.
Oh, great. See, this is the other reason I memorised them, is that my vision now has become highly problematic. Okay, inverse. Imagine the poem is not a clay bowl with all its desire to hold and contain, but the empty space within, a cast hollow, like Rachel Whiteread's house, a counter monument to the bricks and mortar of words, a salute to thin air.
Mm.
So I don't know if everyone knows the reference to Rachel Whiteread. She's a sculptor. I should have probably brought a picture to show you, but she's worth Googling when you go home. She casts negative space. So, say, in a building like this, if there was a big staircase, she'd come in and make cast the hollow underneath the staircase, for instance, and that would then be her sculpture, or the space under a table, or in between the legs of that chair. She's done marvellous things, like for the Holocaust Museum, of casting the space in a bookshelf, you know, here's the shelf, around on top of the books and behind the books. And she says it's, you know, for all the books that didn't get to be written by all the Jewish authors and things like that. Incredibly powerful, this idea of casting the absence.
Mm.
And it was in, I teach a lecture actually called Nothing or No Thing, No Thing. And it talks a lot to artists about presence and absence, how we can represent the absent.
Mm.
Like, instead of having a big monument to the people who are lost, say, to think, how can we represent absence? And so for me, she's very powerful. And it's when you realise that it's not just her, anything we make, the bowl, something as simple as the bowl, what makes it a bowl is not so much what the potter made, here's this lovely shape, it's a bowl because of this space in the middle. Yeah. That's what makes it a bowl, is all that emptiness. And it's just it's a reverse way of thinking. And I get my drawing students at the moment, in fact, my drawing students back home are working on absence. I'm getting them to look at shadows, at things that aren't there. I've given them the impossible task of drawing a hole while I'm away. But it's that idea of how do we capture something that isn't there? Exactly. And so for me, that idea of the holding, the containing, this sense of the space. And I do think poetry plays with presence and absence. And it plays with word and space. I mean, Glyn Maxwell has written a fabulous book, totally worthwhile if anyone wants good reference, called On Poetry.
Mm.
And about the first 20 pages, he talks about the war between the black and the white, the space and the word, sound and silence. It's absolutely fabulous. It's really interesting. And as soon as you open this, we'll say, let's look at this one that I happen to have opened it to. It's called The Door in Four Parts. Here's this blank space. That's representing the door. It's talking about leaving a door ajar. So the words, in a way, aren't important. I mean, of course they're important a little bit, but actually, in a way, this space that's running down the middle is the key to that poem. It's a big chunk of nothing, It's like a bowl with nothing in the middle of it.
But it's the words that create that space.
The words create that space. But I do think that what you're asking is very clever because whilst I am, as you can see, really interested in words, their concrete materiality, I'm also interested, very interested in this sense of space and the way that every line break, I mean, I have almost no... use almost no punctuation in my poetry. So the spaces, often there's big gaps in the middle of things, and I write quite, I make a joke that my pen has never reached the right-hand margin of any page. I have no idea what this side looks like. It's like crossing the Nullarbor. You know, I have lots and lots and lots of space. So for me, quite quickly, when I'm organising my thoughts and I'm writing a poem, I leave a lot of space. One of the first things I do is... little lines, lots of space. It becomes very important. I know it probably hasn't entirely answered your question, but I think it shows the play.
Well, I was thinking, I mean, when you were reading in verse, I was thinking it's almost like, to me, that poem is suggesting that language is the infrastructure, but the poem that's created is something that can't quite be grasped, or the poetry is something more ephemeral than that. And yeah, so I was just kind of really fascinated by the way that poem stood out amongst all the other poems about language and how it's tactile, but the poem is almost